A few months ago, our friend Jerry Cordy, who is a member of this fellowship and a person who usually attends our early service, asked me if I might consider preaching a sermon about Joseph Priestley, our English Unitarian forefather. I'm sorry to say that Jerry was too ill to come this morning, so I told Ruth that I was going to come to his house to deliver the sermon. And I will. I remember learning about Joseph Priestley in seminary. In addition to being instrumental in bringing Unitarianism to America from England, he was a bit of a mad scientist, and he's credited with the discovery of oxygen. Thus the lovely song this morning about breathing. Brilliant. I read up on him a little bit more and learned that in addition to being an innovative theologian and revered chemist, he was a successful writer, a very respected teacher, and a politician with so much influence that he barely escaped England with his life. Indeed, Joseph Priestley seemed to have revolutionized just about every sphere of influence he touched, including the fields of chemistry, physics, education, politics, and religion. His unique worldview distinguished him as a man centuries ahead of his time, and I believe that I can make the argument that his way of thinking is just as important to us Unitarian Universalists today as it was to his contemporaries in the 18th century. Joseph Priestley was born in Yorkshire in 1733. He grew up in a large Calvinist family, but he was kicked out of his Calvinist church because he refused to accept the doctrine of predestination and original sin. Despite this, Priestley identified as a faithful Christian, and he went on to become the minister of a congregation about the size of this congregation, supplementing his income by starting his own school for boys. Around this time, he published his first book, Rudiments of English Grammar. This is a minister. This book, which was the first systematic map of the structure of English language, helped to get him a job at a bigger, more prestigious school called the Warrington Academy. It was about this time in his life that Priestley began to dabble in his favorite hobby, science, which at the time was called natural philosophy. He was particularly interested in the newfangled field of electricity, which was making quite a splash at the time. He bought himself a few simple tools with which to conduct experiments, and he began to play. Soon after that, he decided to write another book, the first ever history of electricity, written in English instead of Latin, which was a big deal, so that the information would be accessible to anyone who wanted to pick up and read about it. Now, Priestley's desire to write this particular book gives us our first hint as to why he was such a remarkable man. Although books about science or natural philosophy had been written in 1765, Priestley took an approach that was new and, dare I say, revolutionary. In the book for which this sermon was named, called The Invention of Air, which I highly recommend, Stephen Johnson writes this: Priestley had a vision of a different kind of book. He had seen more clearly than anyone of his era the possibility of science as a narrative experience. Newton had written a dazzling and inspired brief for his view of how the world worked. But it was ultimately his interpretation of the world that mattered, not the succession of earlier interpretations that led the way to universal gravitation. Priestley saw the value in tracing that chain of events, turning it into a narrative of scientific progress. Newton wanted to persuade his readers to believe in a formula, but Priestley wanted to tell them a story. In order to write his story, Priestley needed to speak to the men who were currently at the forefront of the new field of electricity, including a young Benjamin Franklin. Armed with a letter of introduction, he traveled to a certain London coffee house near St. Paul's Cathedral, where he knew they met every month. They called themselves the Honest Whigs, Whig being spelled W-H-I-G. And they talked about everything from libertarian politics to the need for a rational, quote, rational Christianity, and also theories of electricity, liberally interspersed with wine and cheese and apple puffs. They would stay for hours, pontificating, trying to impress each other. The honest Whigs not only welcomed Priestley into their midst, they loaned him all the literature he needed to learn about the history of the study of electricity. They opened their own research notebooks on the subject, and they also encouraged him to do his own research. Priestley threw himself into his writing and the research. In 1767, he published The History and Present State of Electricity with Original Experiments, which became the standard text on the subject and distinguished him as a member of the scientific community. And this was a man who didn't study science in school at all. It was in this book that the story of Ben Franklin's famous experiment with the key and the kite was first published. The book also contained some of Priestley's own work and even a section called A Description of the Most Entertaining Experiments Performed by Electricity. And in fact, he was very big on parlor tricks. He loved to design contraptions to take to parties to wow everyone. But what was so revolutionary about his approach to writing about electricity as a narrative, a story? Well, Priestley loved science. But unlike many scientists of the day, he also loved dialogue, debate, and the free exchange of ideas. He didn't care about being right or being recognized as the expert. He cared about the progress of humanity. Stephen Johnson explains, he had invented a new way of imagining science. Instead of a unified Newtonian pronouncement, Priestley recast natural philosophy as a story of progress, a raising staircase of enlightenment with each new innovation building on the last. He understood that the more people heard and discussed a concept or idea, and the more input others could give, the better the chance of arriving at some kind of meaningful truth. And this was revolutionary at the time, an important aspect of Enlightenment thought. And while his radical approach was embraced right away by the scientific community, you might imagine that his approach to refining truth was not so welcome when applied to religion or to politics, as we will see later in this story. Ominous foreshadowing. The same year his book was published, Priestley moved his young family to Warrington, where he got a job as a minister at Mill Hill Chapel. Though this was a slightly bigger congregation, Priestley still had plenty of time for his experiments, and it's here that he made his most popular discovery, which he happened upon, just because the temporary home the Priestleys lived in while their new home was being renovated happened to be located right next door to a brewery. Priestley noticed that the fermenting vats of beer gave off what he called fixed air, which we know now was carbon dioxide. The workers at the brewery humored him by letting him experiment with the air over their vats. I'm trying to imagine what that must have been like for these brewery workers when Joseph Priestley wandered in and said, "Can I play with your beer vats?" Priestley was able to carbonate regular water by pouring it back and forth, like this, from one cup to another, over the foam, over the steam that was coming out of the vats. Now, there was a market for sparkling water back in those days, but it had to be taken from rare mineral springs. No one imagined that they could actually produce it. Had Priestley kept his knowledge to himself and sold it later, he could have become a very wealthy man, the father of our modern soda industry. But Priestley believed so much in sharing information freely. So what did he do? He right away went out and printed up a pamphlet, How You Can Make Your Own Soda Water, and gave it to everybody, encouraged them to make their own sparkling water. And it seems a terrible injustice to me that a man named Schweppes later cashed in on Priestley's invention of carbonation. Priestley's discovery, though, set him on a new path, studying the chemistry of air and gas. I have to admit, it was a little hard for me to read about these experiments, which involved lots of mice meeting their maker trapped in a sealed glass jar. Apparently, Priestley had been trapping mice in jars since he was a boy, and he noticed that they died pretty quickly if he screwed on the lid. So he picked up this line of experimentation, and after thoroughly exploring this phenomenon with mice and with frogs, he decided to see what would happen if he sealed a plant in a jar. And he was amazed at what he found. So what he would do is, he would take a jar, and he discovered that if he lit a candle and put the jar over the candle would go out. And there was something different about that air. So that if he put a mouse in a jar and sealed it, the mouse would live, I don't know, 3 or 5 minutes. But if he put a mouse in a jar where he had burned the candle out, the mouse would die almost instantly. So he got interested in what was happening in that jar. So he decided to see what would happen if he put a plant in that jar. And he was amazed to see that the sprig of mint stayed alive, and it stayed alive whether or not he burned the candle out in the jar. Moreover, he found that the sprig of mint, as he called it, which was a plant, a little plant, it was a living plant, that the sprig of mint could actually alter the fate of the mouse. If he put a mouse into a jar in which the flame had previously burned out, the mouse would die right away, but like I said, but when he repeated the experiment, included the mint plant in with the mouse, something entirely different happened. The plant seemed to restore the air somehow for the mouse. As he described in his own words in a letter to Benjamin Franklin, the same mouse also that lived so well in the restored air was barely recoverable after being not more than 1 second in the other. I have also had another instance of a mouse living 14 minutes without being at all hurt in little more than a two-ounce measure of another quality of noxious air in which a plant had grown. So this simple experiment was a major breakthrough. It changed not only what was believed to be the nature of air at the time, but also what we thought we knew about the relationship between plants and people. Franklin wrote back to Priestley saying, "I hope this will give us some check to the rage of destroying trees that grow near houses, which has accompanied our late improvements in gardening, from an opinion of their being unwholesome." So these people were chopping down the trees near their house and moving the gardens farther away because they were unwholesome. Stephen Johnson postulates that this discovery was one of the foundations on which ecosystem science was built. And for this discovery, that is the discovery of oxygen and the way it sustained life, Priestley was awarded the Copley Medal by the Royal Society. And he kept experimenting after that with what was then called subtle fluids, which we now know are gases. And he was the first to identify 10 of them, including oxygen. I should just say that he didn't really have everything correct. I mean, he did identify oxygen, but he wasn't the one who actually figured out how it worked. There were other people needed to step in. But he did have that piece of it. Eventually, Priestley turned his attention to his earlier love, religion. He and his friend, Reverend Theophilus Lindsay, founded the First Unitarian Church in 1774. His most influential work of theology was called History of the Corruptions of Christianity. And in it, he proposed the theory that the religion of Christianity had been corrupted through the ages. The idea of the divinity of Christ was one of such, quote, corruptions. He traced the history of this thinking and found that in the very early church, God was elevated above his son, and it wasn't until the last third century that divinity was bestowed on Jesus. How many of you learned in Sunday school as a child that Jesus was a god? I did. to know. So that's apparently a new thing. That's an innovation. That's a new thing, newer thing. In the corruptions, Priestley broke down every kind of miraculous or magical aspect of Christian theology, including the existence of the Holy Spirit, the Trinity, the predestination, the Eucharist, the deification of saints. Despite this, Priestley understood himself to be a Christian, but faithful to Christianity in its pure form, as it was originally practiced. Priestley's religious ideas had a big influence on Thomas Jefferson, who wrote in a letter to John Adams, "I have read his Corruptions on Christianity and Early Opinions of Jesus over and over again, and I rest on them as the basis of my own faith." Now, just as then, presidential candidates were carefully scrutinized for their beliefs, and Priestley's work enabled Jefferson to reclaim his identity as a Christian. And I'm imagining how history might have gone had that not happened. That's Joseph Priestley. As you might imagine, other religious leaders of the day were not so thrilled with Priestley's ideas. Archdeacon Samuel Horsley called Priestley's writing an extraordinary attempt to unsettle the faith and break up the constitution of every ecclesiastical establishment. Although it seemed that Priestley never set out to enter the world of politics, he couldn't separate his politics from his religion, nor from his science. He preached a sermon in 1785 called The Importance and Extent of Free Inquiry, which included in it this unfortunate metaphor. We are, as it were, laying gunpowder, grain by grain, under the old building of error and superstition, which a single spark may hereafter inflame so as to produce an instantaneous explosion, in consequence of which that edifice, the erection of which has been the work of ages, may be overturned in a moment, and so effectively as the same foundation can never be built upon again. This sermon earned him the nickname Gunpowder Joe and set in motion the events that would result in his having to flee to America. Around the time he preached his infamous sermon, Priestley was hanging around with a group of liberal thinkers calling themselves the Constitutional Society. Some of them were known to support the French Revolution, and they had supported the American Revolution. Their opposition, the opposition to this group, was called the Church and King Movement, and they opposed any sort of revolution as well as any call from the like of Priestley to reform the Church of England. They put an ad in the Birmingham paper in response to one by the Constitution Society saying that whatever the modern Republicans may imagine, or the regicidal propounders of the rights of men design, that means the people who wanted to kill the king. The early service people were like, well, what does that mean? Let us convince them there is enough loyalty in the majority of inhabitants of this country to support and defend their king. One night, upon learning that the Constitutional Society was gathering for a dinner, a mob came to get them. Now, they were smart. So they had their dinner 3 hours earlier. And by the time the mob arrived, they were long gone. This was a problem for the mob. So they went and burned down. So they went and burned down Priestley's church instead, making a bonfire of books and pews on the front step. A friend of Priestley's went to his home and warned him that the mob was coming, and so he was able to escape with his family. But his home, his library, his laboratory were burned to the ground. All that equipment lost. The Priestley's moved to London and tried to live there for a while, very quietly. And Joseph served as a minister in London, but he was shunned by most of the members of the Royal Society for his religious and political views. Eventually, Priestley followed his son to America, where he was building a new settlement in Pennsylvania. Priestley was welcomed in America and offered a position at the University of Pennsylvania in their chemistry department, but he chose instead a quiet family life in Northumberland. He established a Unitarian church in Philadelphia and traveled there to preach occasionally. Sadly, he lost his wife and sons in the same year, just before their new home was finished. And there was yet one more very interesting chapter in his life after this, in which he found himself in trouble yet again for criticizing his new country's fledgling government. But that will have to be another sermon. If you're a scholar of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, you'll know a little bit about this story, but Priestley had an influence on their relationship. What can we take from this story of a man who helped found modern chemistry and our Unitarian faith tradition? So many things. His commitment to free inquiry, his capacity to stand behind his beliefs even when it cost him dearly, personally. His challenge to examine our faith and strip away beliefs that contradict our experience of what is true in the world. These things are still central to our identity as Unitarian Universalists. But what really strikes me in the reading I did about Priestley was his sense of the reality of our interconnectedness. And this is lifted up in Stephen Johnson's book as well. Priestley understood in his time, over 200 years ago, that we don't and we really can't operate in separate spheres. We live connected to each other and to the earth in a way that transcends all specialized fields or interests. He understood that our practices of science, of religion, of politics should be integrated together, must be integrated together. And he believed that everyone's ideas were important and needed if we are to live in a society that is optimally free and just and democratic. This was why he so prized the open exchange of ideas and the dissemination of information. I know if Joseph Priestley were alive today, he would love the internet, and he would be on Facebook every day posting the picture of his latest experiment and his thoughts about the antics of our politicians. I believe that Joseph Priestley sensed the presence of the interconnected web of existence that we cite in our seventh principle, and that so many of us hold so dear. It turns out that he had a hunch that plants had some kind of effect on the air that allowed it to support life. He didn't get all the facts right about the process of respiration, but he did identify oxygen as the substance in air that supports life. That was the piece of the puzzle he contributed. And he didn't mind at all that other minds were needed to get the rest of it right, because being right wasn't what mattered to him. What mattered most was being connected to people, to ideas, and to humanity's progress. May the life of our spiritual ancestor, Joseph Priestley, inspire us as we move throughout the world this week. May we be brave enough to share our visions of a better world. And may we forge connections with each other and the wider world that affirm our lives and the lives of all creatures. Amen.
Because this community of hope and love is important to so many of us, we each bring many gifts into this space.